are or where they were born, close quote. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features Black working class contributions to the Cuban Revolution with Pedro Sardui. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shaw Muiza Muntali. The music in the background is Dari by Omar Sosa and Sekou Keita, commemorating Omar Sosa's birthday, which is April 10, and Jazz Appreciation Month. Black working class contributions to the most recent iteration of the Cuban Revolution are immense and yet somehow missing in discourse around revolutionary Cuba. The long history of African resistance and cultural contributions to Cuban society, which has been intricately connected to global Black freedom movements, has been in rhythmic continuity until present day. An illustration of this is Kalata Lukumi and Femina are remembered for their parts planning and leading a 1843 revolt of enslaved Africans in colonial Cuba. Then there's Rosa Castellanos, who was a freed slave, medic, and soldier in the 10 Years' War. At the outset of the war in 1868, Castellanos used her knowledge of indigenous medical herbs to treat injured soldiers. As fighting intensified, Castellanos and her husband, also formerly enslaved, built a life-saving field hospital. As we move further, we come to understand the role that Juan Almeida, born into a Black working class family in Havana, who also worked as a bricklayer from age 11, played in the Cuban Revolution. In fact, the underground revolutionary cell he joined was made up of several construction workers to Angola, to Cape Verde, to Guinea-Bissau, to Mozambique. Individuals such as Victor Drake epitomize Cuba in Africa, Africa in Cuba. He served as second-in-command under Ernesto Che Guevara in the Congo. The continuities are clear and important on many levels. That is on the level of internal, as confronting the internal contradictions, specifically the necessity to fight the colonial structure, the vestiges of racism in Cuban society in an added terrain of struggle. It is here the dialectical process of liberation finds its most articulate expression. Now that the process of decolonization has been initiated in its continued anti-colonial struggle that takes precedence, the struggle to heighten the internal contradictions, which is a struggle in its totality, a struggle against the coloniality of being, where the vestiges of old forms of oppression are presented in new ways. In the case of Cuba, where colonial structures of race, racism, are used to try to undo the revolutionary process of creating a liberated territory. Today we present a conversation from a few weeks ago with Pedro Sardui, where we engage in a discussion that is in essence a mapping of the anti-colonial process. Pedro Perez Sardui is a poet, writer, journalist, and broadcaster living in Puerto Rico, London, and Havana. He is the author of Suriedad, Combit, and other poems. He is also co-editor with Gene Stabs of Afro-Cuba, an anthology of Cuban writing on race, politics, and culture, and co-author of the anthology No Longer Invisible, Afro-Latin Americans Today. His journal in Babylon is a series of chronicles on Britain. His first novel, The Maids of Havana is based on his mother's life stories about pre- and post-revolutionary Havana. This is the first novel by a contemporary Afro-Cuban writer on family life in Cuba. Together with Gene Stabbs, he wrote Afro-Cuban Voices on Race and Identity in Contemporary Cuba. Sarduri has read his works internationally and lectured regularly on race, politics, and culture at academic institutions globally. He has received a number of awards for his poetry. Here is Pedro Sarduri with African Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope.
I'd like to extend a warm welcome and gratitude for having someone who is influential on many different levels. He's going to be new to some of you, but a comrade and friend to others of who those of you who are going to be engaging the program. I'd like to extend thank you for taking the time to join us today, Brother Pedro. How are you?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, James. It's amazing.
Yes.
For such many years just to before the pandemic, actually.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, I've mentioned to you offline that, you know, this, I don't know why I hadn't had you in so many years, but here we are. And so with that being said, let's begin with a brief, but any length you would like to share, biography, or maybe like an intellectual biography, a political or a cultural development. Could you talk a little bit about the various influences as a Black Cuban from a working class family? Could you talk a little bit about that particular environment that produced someone who's actually provided work that opened up many avenues of inquiry, particularly around race, culture, politics in Cuba that spans the globe, by the way? Could you give us just a little bit, share as much as you want, are as short as you
I put all that into my writing in my last book, which is unpublished, which I call Memoir, My Memories in Spanish, right? I write Memorias, Mis Memoria. And I began writing about my grandmother, my great-grandmother, and my extended family. My father had 9 brothers and 4 sisters. And my mother had 9 sisters and 4 brothers. They were 14. And I grew up with my grandmother, who was very anti-white. She said that I remember when I used to have my friends in the different level of my education, she was always angry when I had a friend who was a white guy. And she pulled me by with my teeth, my ear, and said, I don't want to see you playing around with those folk because blah, blah, blah. What I meant is that my very, very first intake into race was with the mother of my father. She passed away around, I believe, in the 1980s, age of, I believe, nearby the 90s, 1991. And I grew up at her big house, because my parents split when I was about 7, 8, and my mother went to Havana to work as a servant, as a maid. And my father was a shoemaker in Santa Clara. And the only one who decided to go to pursue this, what could I say, the further academic and higher education studies was me, and who want to continue. So I didn't have any kind of home support that you have to go to the school, you have to do this. It was my own one. And my first writing was about all that kind of environment in which I grew up with my extended family. And then I decide, I remember that at the beginning of the revolution in the 1960s, it was a year and a half, where higher education was cool, was a stop. And I have to make a kind of full exam in order to embody, in order to get into the university. And the university closest one to me was in Santa Clara, who was very upper white, mostly white student. And I remember that Ernesto Che Guevara, very well known by Che, was to say that the university, the higher education, have to get dressed for white, for mixed race, for black, white people. So I get into it, and I first went into the university in Santa Clara, who was a very segregated city. I wrote about that in my memoirs. Segregating in many ways. Black neighborhood, white neighborhood. And it happened that my grandmother used to live in what was a very well-known street, large street, who was from where Che Guevara came in Santa Clara, the last battle, in order to get to join for the revolution. And the name was Jose Martí, Calle Martí, ironically, because Martí's idea was, let's say, digamos, Cubanos es más que, Cuban is more than white, more than black, more than mulatto. You say Cuban and you embrace the whole sphere and people. But there were just three black families all along about a mile and a half of Calle Martí. And there were two or three black families in that very same block of the street. So I faced all that kind of situation when I went to the higher education to move here, to move there. And I wanted to narrate all that kind of environment next to me. And I decided to write about all that. I went to the university in Santa Clara. Then I joined the nationalized, in the 1960s. The whole American company were nationalized, was intervened by the revolutionaries. So I worked for the Cuban Telephone Company, the Cuban Telephone Company, who was owned by almost everything in Cuba, by the American big capital. And I was the very first black folks working in the night shift, which began in any of the automatic manual telephone companies, blackboard or board. And I was the only black folk doing the training before getting the full job. And I was making, when I finished the training, I was making more money than any of my members of the family. And I was born in 1943. So I'm talking about my 70s. I was a teenager. And I used to go very well dressed, and I have to plug in to my next neighbor. And anytime I went about to plug this woman, white women, I used to do like that in order not to feel that I was about to touch her or feel like that. I grew up into that environment. So I put all that into my writing in one way or another. But I decide just to write about from where I come from, fighting for the situation embodied into my hometown, Santa Clara, where the square, the park, promenade, both for three kind of Cubans, local Cubans, around the Glorieta, where the band played music, there was some white folks. The other one was for mixed race, and the one upside nearby the street was for black folks. Could you believe a town? And then the people, I grew up in that kind of environment. It was there. I wrote something called Open Letter to Carlos Moore. And where I met Carlos Moore Robert Williams, who went to Cuba to find out what the Castro was doing against racism. So that was after we managed just to clear the barrier of the Parque Vidal de Santa Clara. So I put all that background, and I even, James, didn't think that I want to be a writer. I want to write about all the sort of things without the idea. Well, I mean, I grew up in the high school, bachillerato, and there were intellectual people. I like the jazz. I like the cultural music. I like the American writer. I remember reading James Baldwin when in the 60s, and I didn't have a clue who he was. But I found it interesting, so I wanted to learn languages in order to read other books. So I started with Russian, I did English, I did the English I did at the university, I did French at the university, and I did Portuguese later on, because I wanted to find out what was beyond the island and archipelago of Cuba. So I was involved with that kind of people. Some of the people were kind of giving kind of voluntary teaching what was good for you to read. We went into the Buddhism. We went into the ancient philosophy. We moved different way. We were a group of white, gay people, or mixed race Cubans. Upper middle class people, bourgeois people, all that together blend into the root of some of us, how can I put it, graying, nurturing what we will be able to do and to be in the near future. What I did all my life, journalism and literature, and writing about my memories, I decided, whoa, when I managed just to decide to do that, if I didn't have any helping, support, background in my family at all. Mm-hmm. I remember that being in the bachillerato, in the high school, before the university, we called bachillerato, or in French, it's baccalauréat. And in my household, there was a ceiling lamp in the living room, and next to it was the very first room, open just with a curtain, and my granny used to go in the second bed in a big room. So she called me, she named my name and said, "Ramosito, why don't you turn off the lights? You're going to become crazy reading at this time." and I laughed about that, but she was literate, completely literate. So that's the way I move and grew up into that. And since then until right now, I am embedded into all my books in one way over there, the book I bought from Cuba. I have a book over there that says Music, Ifa Divination, Black Africa, and Orin Oricha. Miles Davis over there, one of my favorite musicians. I grew up in that. And my very first visit to America was in 1985. In 1985, my very first visit. And I went because a poet called Phyllis Yannick from Chicago. I went to Cuba and she wanted just to take a group, small group, three people, a comedian, a handicraft man, and myself, a poet. And I was already known in poetry because I won at the age of 23, 1966, a very important Casa de las Américas Prize Award. Not the first one, because the first one went into a very well-known Chilean poet, but I got the very first mention before, ahead of other greatest Latin American poets. And that was a name. I mean, that was, I said, that was for me the first prize. And you will be able to see some pictures that I sent to you into my in the book, when I was even with my suit, I have to request for a friend to lend me the suit, because at the time you have to go very well dressed to that kind of premiere. And I didn't have a penny. I was in Havana, 1966. So I continue, James, into that until right now, traveling, moving around. I've been able to have about four or five scholarship in America. I was a writing resident at Columbia University. I have a fellowship here, Rockefeller Fellowship here in Puerto Rico in 97, 98. And then I have a visiting fellowship in Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. I move around, I travel around in the United States. I make a lot of friends in America. I learned a lot from you. And that kind of continuous nurturing is what really kept me with the thirsty of knowing more and more about our struggle, which is not the same, but it's very similar and very important.
I wanted to unpack a little bit because, again, you mentioned Santa Clara, and you, in previous interviews, and you also written about this, you know, I wanted to kind of go back and talk about the influence of that revolution on you and your generation. You were a teenager when you saw Che and Camilo and their column come, you know, liberate Santa Clara, which proved to be that decisive victory. Yeah. It was undoubtedly impactful on you. You once stated that, I think we felt closer to Che and Camilo because of their youthfulness and enthusiasm. And, you know, of course, knowing you, that still is there. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, kind of seeing that? And then you eventually, I think you also talk about how it influenced you to write poetry and influenced you to write a poem about the revolution itself. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, that influence? You were there in Santa Clara.
Yes. Yeah. And I saw the guy in front of me, because most of people older than me were involved in the revolution struggle. Actually, I had a cousin who was in the Sierra del Escambray in the province. But my very first poem was a love poem that I published later on in a Polish review, monthly review called Radar. But those years, I didn't write anything about. I was involved in moving, in going to the university, in the struggle against racism in Santa Clara, because the very first speech against racism was in Santa Clara, my hometown, by Fidel Castro. It was in early 1960, because the revolution triumphed in 1960. And the first, what I wrote about it, I call affirmative action, I was practically the subject of affirmative action, because in order to work for the just nationalized Cuban telephone company, who was, as I said, owned by American company, it was request to have to be educated. I have my bachillerato, I have my diploma, to be young and to be black, because the company was completely white folks. No, the telephone and the electric company were mostly white people. The big store like Woolworth, like all the American chains, Minimax, what? White people. So it was very important because the American influence was there. It was there. Absolutely. The bank didn't employ black people. So when you face that, you are part of the situation. You take it or you leave it. You acknowledge it or you disregard it. You say, no, I have nothing to do with that. But because of my family was an extended family, four of my aunties, women, sister of my father, were for the Cuban cigar company doing the tobacco leaf steaming, I believe that was the name. And I used to take the lunch for her, for two of my aunties. Mostly black women working in that store. So the guy who owns a big store in the corner of my block where I used to live in the street, where I used to live with my granny, was a mixed race guy who said, wait until Fidel Castro comes down. You will see, he's going to put all black people into a boat and he's going to sink it in the sea. Could you believe that? Mm. And I was a teenager. Listening to that anytime I used to go to the store. So it was amazing kind of racism that people, many people, deny Cuba was like that. And it was not just in Santa Clara, it was Camagüey, it was Santiago de Cuba, areas in Santiago de Cuba, Cienfuegos, south of, because Las Villas used to have 32 municipalities, and Cienfuegos was mostly white, mixed race, upper to middle class, very beautiful city in the south of the province. And Santa Clara was the capital of the 32 municipalities in the province. Cuba used to have six provinces: Pinal del Río, Matanza, Las Villas, Camagüey, y Oriente, all that. So, being into that, it was nurturing my sense of finding out why. Because my grandmother and my father and my parents couldn't answer that question. And I have the influence all the time on top of me, because I grew up with my granny, that didn't want me to see next to any white folk. So I said, well, he's a good friend of mine. Why I can't, and the park and the revolution and all that. And suddenly I see myself involved in to take a kind of transforming protagonist at the age of 17, 18, 19, 20, without being able, without having been able to fight physically for the revolution, like my cousin, who was older than me. And he came with the grade of captain. So that was the most important thing for people like my extended family. Very, very important, that change of process in the Cuban history, who were very Americanized country, very into the mindset of being American. The Cuban white people, where my mother used to work for, used to go shopping in the Gulf. On Friday, they take the ferry and going to Miami and going to Key West and going to here and there. Vacation in America. This and, yeah, there was all the South. Cuba was very Americanized. And still, even the working class people prefer the American items rather and appliances rather than the Russian when they came in the 60s. My mother used to have a fridge there in 1952, and her husband, when after she divorced from my father, won a Soviet kind of frigidaire. And my mother said, no. I don't want that sort of thing because this 1952 never collapsed. And the Russian, with those snow that they have, they don't know what's the fridge. But just to let you know, an idea of how close is that kind of hate and love relationship. Mm-hmm. Baseball, how many Cuban used to have black baseball player playing in the Black League mm-hmm. of baseball in the United States. Boxing, musician, coach, all that sort of things. Chano Pozo played with Duke Ellington. Mm-hmm. All those people. So that's what I meant. It's not a hate, but that kind of love and hate relationship with the United States is infatuated with the Cuban. And so that's had been the topic and the issue of my writing all the way.
You listened to a recent conversation with Pedro Sardui, consisting in essence of a mapping of the continuous anti-colonial process in Cuba and beyond. Pedro Perez Sardui is a poet, writer, journalist, and broadcaster living in Puerto Rico, London, and Havana. Pedro Sardui is an author of numerous books, articles, and poems, and is a recipient of a number of awards for his poetry. The music in the background is Jazz Bata by Chucho Valdez, commemorating Jazz Appreciation Month. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
And your utilization of poetry and so your sociopolitical writings, because you've written extensively on race, you know, has a range and depth that centers the Afro-Cuban presence and contributions to Cuban political and cultural life as well. And, you know, the reason why this is an important topic to talk about, because a lot of times, people use race as a red herring or a straw argument, particularly in assessing Cuba. But it is an important issue to talk about because it is ingrained, particularly in the colonial structures.
Definitely. And it's,
you know, talk a little bit more about, you know, you talked about, you know, how you were growing up, you know, the impact of the revolution. Now, the revolution happens and now there is an attempt or there is, okay, now there has to be some levels of equity and equality. Could you talk a little bit about, you talked about a little bit about, you know, working in the telephone company, you going into the university. That particular time is really addressing, you inherited the revolution. You mentioned something very interesting. You didn't get a chance to fight, but you also inherited an internal fight to get rid of the vestiges of that colonial structure. And so this pushes you into journalism. This pushes you into poetry, radio. Could you talk a little bit more about that evolution of the struggle, particularly for you?
Moving into Havana in 1962, I won a scholarship to do a kind of, how could I put it? Let's put it the way. From the very beginning, culture was very important for the new leaders, above all by Fidel Castro. Sport, music, cultural, embrace culture in general. Could you believe a man, a politician as such as him, involved in creating and supporting the National Cuban Ballet. A lawyer. He was involved in ballet, creating, and this is why Cuba have this greatest school of ballet. And this is why it was white, but one of the best one Cuban dancer in ballet, which is retired, is a black guy. And now heading the company in Birmingham. He was made sir in England. And he made a movie out of his life. And he have a company in Cuba. So just to give you an idea, the possibilities that people like me where the only paper that you used to find in my household was a paper, and it was in the toilet. A newspaper, and it was in the toilet. Just to let you know, there was nothing to read. So it was open, all the possibility for people like my background. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to be talking to you right now here. Definitely. And because I went to Havana, I applied to a competition. And the competition was, you have to submit a writing to be selected for nationally to take a course in Havana. I sent my very first short story called Seven Dead Seasons, about the 7 years I spent it was with a sister of my mother in the countryside. And my father was in the capital city of the province. So I wrote about that. I sent 1962, Pedro, the end of 61. And I won with another local Cuban who was a violinist and a poet. Here I am at the just recent nationalized Havana Hilton Hotel, who was become the Havana Libre Hotel. After that, I am recalling now, the first visit to Havana was running on the marathon. I was an athlete running marathon from Santiago de Cuba to Havana, and I joined the group in Santa Clara. And we arrived in Havana, and we were about to, just to celebrate the very first year of the revolution, with the torch, pam, 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 running all along. And we supposed to be staying at the recent nationalized Havana Hilton. But most of the runners and the athletes were black folks. And the guy who was still from the Hilton didn't want to set black people over there. So Camilo Cienfuegos, another guy with a long beard, brown, came. We were upside. You remember the Havana mm-hmm. Libre, after mm-hmm. kind of entering mm-hmm. the cars and leaving. Mm-hmm. Well, we were upside waiting to see what was going on that we couldn't get into the hotel. So that was my very first visit. My second visit, because I went to see my mother in 1950s when she was working as a maid. So later on in the 60s, when I went to do the studies, one of the very first professor who became in the future my compadre was the one who gave the name of my very first son, which is 50. He was born in 72, my elder son, Rogelio Martinez Fure, a very well-known Cuban Africanist who passed away. And the very first time that I heard intellectualizing, giving a cultural deep, deep, deep sense of Africa and Africanism and the African diaspora, which at the time nobody talked about the black diaspora. I'm talking about 1962, and he gave his lecture for an hour and a half, 2 hours, once a week. Rogelio Martinez Fure. He was a kind of injection into my blood to understand and to make me and many others. We were three black folks. One is Tomás Robaina, which is in Santa Clara, writing his book. He wrote a lot about black. The other one is a musician in Santa Clara, still alive, and myself. We were just three black folks from the island story, that kind of thing. What can I say? He wrote plenty of books that I have here. Look at it. This was published 1988. Divan Africano, Poets of French Expression by Rogelio Martinez Furet. He wrote all in Spanish. This guy was born in 1937 and he passed away last year. So he was the kind of godfather of all of us, my generation, those who wanted to get into it. And then you say, my goodness, there is something more than the Santeria and just that landed in Cuba, which, by the way, member of my family was deep into that. Black Cubans were not used to go to church, just a minority, because Cubans have the African in which to believe. And even that I was, even if I was baptized at the age of 5, I never went back as unaffiliated, like the American culture people go on Sunday morning. And I remember that my first time, my first visit to Chicago, I said to one of my hosts, I want to go to a morning Sunday church. And I was, my goodness, it becomes Chicago my kind of town. Yeah, I love Chicago. And people say, but it's very cold. I said, I don't care. The very first time I went up to the south side of Chicago, oh my goodness, I was bargaining. I said, this food is what we eat in Cuba, I said to the people. And then I went to Harlem. Anyway, just to let you know that it was a kind of combination between what I discovered. And once you discover all the literature, you wanted to read Che Canta Diop, you want to go here, and you say, my goodness, there's a whole world outside that I never was mentioned to me. Why I have to do Latin and Greek and to know the Pharaoh and to know this and that and to know the culture in Italy. And never anybody taught me about Africa, even at the university. I learned before at the University 60 about the Fontana di Trevi in Italy rather than the Benin bronze. So just to tell you how important culture was for the revolution and the need and the thirst in order to learn more and more and more and more and more and more. That you never stop. And it was free. We didn't have to pay tuition because education was free. You do whatever you want to do. You want to learn. You don't have to be a member of the communist youth or the party or anything like that. The culture was there. So what you have to do is just sign in and just move into. So I did English. I did English. I did French. I did Portuguese. I went to university and I graduated with diploma into French literature. And I love the French culture. And I love this. But then I link it up to the French, the Antilles. And I found out that there was poetry and literature written in French by Antillean people, Caribbean people, and English people. So I went to that. So I went to England later on, and I found the West Indian community over there that was disregarding Cuba, because they used to come to Cuba and say, can you call the labor force in the eastern part of Cuba? So that kind of example, why we discriminate against them if they are part of us? Because they speak English, they speak French, they speak Creole. There's a large community of Haitian. And do you remember that when we were in Santiago de Cuba, mm-hmm. in the eastern mm-hmm. part of Cuba, all that kind of coffee where we drank coffee over mm-hmm. there, that was part of the Haitian. They were preserving that kind of landmark in Cuba. So it was a whole mixture. And then landing in America, oh my goodness, I remember in the 1980s, I used to go, I finished at Hunter College or Columbia University, and I took the one train down to Harlem. Enjoy the Harlem culture with all the people.
Yeah. You know, this is absolutely fascinating. I mean, how does this look today? How does that particular period, the robust, you know, access and the hunger, I've been to Cuba a number of times, particularly with you, and there is a there's tons of conversations on the African presence, you know, Cuban, you know, balancing act. What does it mean to be Cuban? What does it mean to be Afro-Cuban? Could you talk a little bit more? And also, how does race?
Oh, no, you're talking too loud. That's true. I get into chatting with that. That's what I don't need. You remember at university that I didn't have a microphone.
Yeah. We heard you all the way back.
All the way. Anyway, but that's a very interesting question, because my generation have to fight against the intolerance in that line. But now, even I remember when I was working for the radio in Cuba, people really shout me on the street because I have an Afro. Because I come from that generation of the Black is Beautiful, who was spread out everywhere. And coming, being Black, working in a radio station, the main radio station opposite, collateral to the Havana Libre, a huge building over there. And there were no Black journalists, and there were no Black actors or actresses, just a few. So being in that kind of element and looking at what Black Cubans are doing right now, because we were the one that we fought against that, because we have a background, and the background was those generals, Antonio Maceo, Moncada, who fought against Spain during the struggle. So whenever they wanted us to put us aside, we raised our voice and we fought for that. So now it's totally different. The very first couple on a main newscast broadcasting emission is right now in Cuba at 8 o'clock. It wasn't a kind of, how could I put it? Radio and television was very important in Cuba, because it was the first or the second in Latin America, Spanish Latin America, where the American television came. Don't forget that American car used to be tested in Havana. Mm-hmm. Tested in Havana. So everything was American cars, everything. 1950-something, the television in Cuba, in Havana. No Black people anywhere. And now, you see Black women and men proud to shout out, we are Black Afro-Cubanos. And this came because there was a background struggle that began with people like me, my generation. In one way or another, we dropped a grain, a drop of sand against and fighting for, and we didn't relinquish. And wherever we are, friends of mine, musicians who fought against the prohibition of playing jazz in Cuba in the 1960s, in the 1970s, jazz was something like, this is the culture of the imperialism. I say, no, this is the music of the American Black folks. And we were a group. Very well-known name like Chucho Valdez, for instance, or Paquito de Rivera. And we say, don't forget that Chano Pozo playing with Duke Ellington. And we defending the jazz is part of our culture. Now, jazz festival in Cuba every year. And I was part of, I was living in England when I covered the very first jazz festival about 30 years ago. And it was amazing to see all that. There's a Cuban saxophonist and trumpeter and flutist who play with Duke Ellington in Cuba. No, Duke Ellington, no. I'm talking about the other one.
This Gillespie.
So what I'm saying is that it's a different kind of blue what we have right now in Cuba. Jazz festival in Santiago de Cuba, in Havana. And we were part of that fighting back when the prohibition or the kind of disregarding that kind of imperialism music. We were against that kind of state of mind of many people involving that. The writing, the poetry, the music, above all the culture. What can I say? I remember in Havana, I listened to, when I get to work, I began to work for the radio in Havana in 1965. Next to there were another station from where the American Robert Williams.
Oh, you're talking about Radio Free Dixie.
That's right.
Okay. So yes.
We were close. My radio station.
Yes.
You just been listening to a portion of a recent conversation between Pedro Sardui and African Owl's executive producer and co-host James Pope, which in essence consisted of a mapping of the continuous anti-colonial process in Cuba and beyond. Pedro Perez Sardui is a poet, writer, journalist, and broadcaster living in Puerto Rico, London, and Havana. Pedro Sardui is the author of numerous books, articles and poems, and is recipient of a number of awards for his poetry. Some of his publications are co-editor with Gene Stabs of Afro-Cuba, an anthology of Cuban writing on race, politics and culture, and co-author of the anthology No Longer Invisible, Afro-Latin Americans Today. His journal in Babylon is a series of chronicles on Britain. His first novel, The Maids of Havana, is based on his mother's life stories about pre- and post-revolutionary Cuba. The full conversation will be available on African Owl's SoundCloud page. That's African Owl Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Maiden Voyage by Herbie Hancock, commemorating Herbie Hancock's birthday, which is April 12th, and Jazz Appreciation Month. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muizo Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shaanana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at the situation in Gaza and the rest of Palestine and the rest of the Middle East and North African region, which is followed by the women's collective, Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by Human Rights and Justice with Nkechi Taifa, and that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, and which is followed by Kombiti Lakai with Eugenia Charles, looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineer, Michael Nicella. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Kozer and Funan Gonda. And thanks to our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Kishikan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Oderson. Thanks to the entire team here at WPFW, and thanks to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We'll leave you the closing song entitled Tanga Suite by Mario Bowser, commemorating Jazz Appreciation Month. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, April 17th. Here are some headlines. The Senate is convening today for the impeachment trial of Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. First, the full Senate will be sworn in as jurors. Meanwhile, Senate Democrats could move as swiftly as today to dismiss or table the articles of impeachment on a simple majority vote. House Republicans sent two articles to the Senate yesterday accusing Mayorkas of allegedly failing to enforce immigration laws and of lying to Congress by saying the border was secure. Democrats have dismissed the matter as a political misuse of the impeachment process and claim that policy disagreements are not a justification for the rarely used constitutional impeachment of a cabinet official. Mayorkas is only the second cabinet secretary to be impeached in U.S. history. In state news, Democrats in the Arizona House of Representatives today are seeking to repeal an 1864 ban on abortion that is poised to become state law once again. But they will need the help of some Republicans in the closely divided legislature. A state Supreme Court ruling on April 9th revived a ban on nearly all abortions under a law written during the U.S. Civil War, when Arizona was not yet a state and women lacked the right to vote. The law, which would take effect within 60 days, imposes a sentence of 2 to 5 years for anyone found guilty of inducing an abortion except for a doctor who deems it necessary to save the life of the mother. Arizona House Democrats sought to repeal the ban a week ago, but were thwarted by the narrow Republican majority. In Virginia, an Army general who investigated the abuse of prisoners 20 years ago at Iraq's infamous Abu Ghraib prison testified yesterday that a civilian contractor instructed prison guards to soften up detainees for interrogations. The testimony provided by retired General Antonio Taguba was the strongest evidence yet that civilian employees of the Virginia-based military contractor CACI played a role in the abuse of Abu Ghraib inmates. In a trial that began Monday, three former inmates at the prison are suing CACI, alleging that the company contributed to the torturous treatment they suffered. The trial, delayed by more than 15 years of legal wrangling, is the first time that Abu Ghraib inmates have been able to bring a civil case in front of a U.S. jury. And global progress in making childbirth safer for women has basically stalled since 2016, according to the UN Population Fund. The agency released its annual State of World Population report today, with inequality as its focus. The report indicates around 800 women die daily while giving birth and estimates that a pregnant African woman is around 130 times more likely to die in childbirth than a woman in Europe or North America. It also found, quote, women of African descent across the Americas are more likely to die when giving birth than white women, close quote. In a statement, the agency said, quote, sweeping global gains in sexual and reproductive health and rights over the last 30 years are marred by an ugly truth. Millions of women and girls have not benefited because of who they are or where they were born, close quote. For WP.